Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week. I'm your host, Hank Sanders. Join us every Saturday for a deep discussion about the biggest stories of the week. Go behind the scenes with journalists, political figures, and newsmakers to get a unique look at our city. And also, I want to hear from you, the listener. So please send any questions, critiques, or sponsorship inquiries to my email at hsanders@wweek.com. Thank you so much and enjoy this episode of the Dive Podcast. Welcome back to the Dive Podcast. I'm your host, Hank Sanders. It's great to have you with us today on October 9th for episode 41 of the Dive. We have a great show for you today. We are joined by reporter Tess Riske, who is here to tell us all about a poaching ring that Oregon police have infiltrated. And no, I am not talking about that cooking technique where you lightly boil things. I am talking about illegally killing protected wildlife for sport. But before we get into that story, here are all the headlines, everything that happened this week. This is the 9 Second News Flash. As we covered on the show before, Speaker of the House Tina Kotek has announced she is running for governor of Oregon. However, she will not be stepping down from her speakership while she runs. She will attempt to remain in that role through the 2022 session. That being said, she has a competitor. Democratic Representative Janelle Bynum is running against her for a second time. She ran last year for the same position, but then withdrew when it was clear that she didn't have the votes and the votes were going to Ms. Kotek. Bynum said that Kotek still being in that role will not dissuade her from running as she calls for new leadership. Side note, we had Rep. Bynum on our show a few weeks ago. Go back, listen to that episode. It's an interesting discussion. Really appreciated her time. We've also talked about redistricting that is going on in our state. As part of the redistricting, there is an open House district. House District 25 is here for the taking, and we have our first candidate. Tigard and Tualatin School Board Chair Ben Bowman is the first person to throw his name in the ring for that seat. We will keep you updated on what's going on in HD 25. Moving right along, the Oregon Medical Examiner says deaths related to alcohol rose faster than deaths related to drug overdoses last year. A lot of this has to do with being stuck at home and also, you know, there being less emergency room beds. You know, it's fun because we've been doing this show for a long time and we've been doing it long enough where we can kind of reflect back to a story that we talked about a while ago and then bring it back up. That's where we're at now. So let's do that here. Remember a while back when legislators in Salem were working on all those bills to allow bars to sell takeout liquor when the bars were closed due to stay-at-home orders? Well, the executive director of a group called Oregon Recovers said, quote, "During COVID, the Oregon legislature disregarded public health warnings and worked overtime to increase alcohol sales. They made no effort to advise people on the dangers of consuming alcohol while isolated at home," unquote. Damn, this guy does not play around. Very interesting topic. If you're an Oregon voter, you may know that last session there was a ballot measure that got passed that increased taxes in order to increase funding for homeless services. Willamette Week wrote a story about how some have been critical about the relationship between the programs looking to receive the money and the civic leaders whose job it is to hand out the cash. Some are worried that that relationship is too close. This is a very complicated topic, so to explain it better, let me bring in the author of the story, Willamette Week's Nigel Jaquess.
So this story is about the Multnomah County Joint Office of Homeless Services, which is going to have a budget of more than $150 million this year. Some critics, including people who are closely involved in setting policy around how that money will be spent, have raised questions about possible conflicts of interest between the nonprofit providers who set policy for the joint office and those same providers who also have contracts with the joint office. So we're talking about tens of millions of dollars a year in contracts that are held by people who are also deciding how the money will be spent.
Portland voters voted overwhelmingly. It was like 42 to 50 something percent in favor of a tax to increase money that would go to homeless services. And this is expected, obviously, like you've mentioned, to increase the budget by over $100 million. Are we at all concerned that maybe the money will be just blown through more than it should be, and will be there'll be more waste because of these relationships between the civic leaders, where the money's going, and who's receiving the money?
Well, the concerns that people who are on the board have raised are that nonprofits who stand to benefit from this new flow of money may not be interested in doing things differently. They may not be interested in innovation. They haven't been particularly interested in data. So yes, there is a big concern about whether the operations will be transparent, whether the contracts will be done at an arm's length, and most importantly, whether the outcomes are as good as possible. I think, you know, for the next 10 years, we're going to see $2.5 billion flow into county governments from this measure. And I think the voters who passed that overwhelmingly, as you pointed out, really want to see change on the streets, and they want to see dramatic change. And so the critics are concerned that we won't see as much change or as much progress because of some of these interlocking relationships.
Last but not least, let's talk about something that we don't talk about much on the show, and that is soccer. Two former Portland Thorns players published allegations against a former Thorns coach in a Athletic report in the Athletic, the magazine. They alleged that he sexually harassed them, including in one instance alleging that he asked the two players to kiss each other in exchange for missing a portion of the next day's workout. The two athletes also discussed getting little to no support from the front office and detailing how their interactions cost them their jobs as professional athletes and didn't see any ramifications for the coach. So interesting story there. Suzette Smith, our editor, covers that story. And then obviously the new development that happened this week, where the franchise placed general manager Gavin Wilkinson on administrative leave pending the results of an internal investigation of these claims. So we will revisit this story, but for now, this has been the 90 Second Newsflash. Folks, we now turn to our main story. Over the last year, Oregon police have infiltrated a group of Oregon wildlife poachers. These people have a series of texts and group chats where they show off the illegal killing of wild animals. The main alleged poacher, Willie Hollings, who was convicted of sex crimes back in 2005, is getting the book thrown at him as Oregon police look to crack down on these acts to prevent a potential extinction of some of Oregon's most prized wildlife species. I had questions for Tess about her cover story all about this topic. Let's run the interview. Okay, Tess, let's start here. How did you find out about this story?
I found out about this story just like mostly on my own, kind of organically. My editor, Aaron, had suggested I look for a true crime story to do as a cover story at some point. And I know Mark Sussman, the owner, was also interested in the true crime story. So I kind of just kept my eyes out for one to do for the last couple of months. And then, because that's a very broad topic, obviously, there's a million things that could mean. And it's really a matter of, you know, what is available already, because a lot of crime stories are kind of delayed if it hasn't been like adjudicated yet. And so I didn't really know what I was looking for, but I wanted to do something like, you know, a little bit different than just a standard crime of, you know, maybe like a murder of some sort. I wanted to write about something that is a little bit not typically covered, I guess. And then Oregon State Police, which is discussed a lot in this story, sent out a press release at this time about some people they had arrested related to poaching. And just like that press release was just sort of like, oh, interesting. And I noticed, you know, towards the bottom, they had mentioned like the amount of points that you can earn depending on like the type of poacher you turn in, if you turn one in, depending on what kind of animals are involved and stuff like that. So I was just fascinated kind of by this system.
You talk about a few tactics that police use to catch poachers, and one of them made me laugh, and that was the putting a decoy animal out in the forest or out in a field and then waiting for somebody to shoot the animal, thinking that it's a live animal. Yeah. And you write that it is the same, or under Oregon law, it's the same penalty. They don't distinguish between shooting a replica, a decoy animal, and a regular animal. How could that possibly be? How is it the same penalty to shoot a figurine buck versus something that's actually living?
I mean, I don't really fully understand like the legalese as to why that is the way it is, but the way it's been explained to me by OSP troopers who do these decoy missions, which are fascinating. I haven't been on one and I would love to. But it's like, you know, they place these animals in a setting where if you're a hunter, you would know these regulations. So for example, like they will put the deer out. Black-tailed deer, they'll place them out at night and do nighttime decoy missions with them. So no matter what, you know, if you're shooting at a deer at night, it's point blank illegal. It's not allowed. You can't hunt within 30 minutes of sunset or sunrise. So it's just like, you know, you shot at this creature believing it was real, right? Most people are not going to shoot at a deer knowing it's a decoy. And so I don't totally understand exactly why it is that is, you know, not distinguished as different in the eyes of the law, but it does make sense because the person who's shooting at whatever that decoy is assuming the animal's real, right? I put it this way when I was talking to some of the OSP troopers of like, it really reminds me of the TV show To Catch a Predator, where like, you know, there's an adult who's posing as a minor, right? And at least as far as the premise of the show, I'm sure it's different. Every case is different state by state, but like, you know, the premise of the show is like, well, you thought this was a minor you were going to meet up with. Doesn't matter that it's actually an adult. It's the same kind of concept here. So it's just really fascinating.
I'm a very amateur fisher. I don't really call myself a fisher at all, but I like going fishing with my, you know, friends or family. And I usually only go if I have a guided trip where I have a guide who knows everything, or I go with a friend who knows the body of water or something like that. And that's because I wouldn't catch anything just alone, but also because, you know, I don't know if I'm taking home too much or too little, or not too little, but, you know, taking the wrong fish home or whatever it might be. So how often do the police get somebody who just is an amateur hunter who just genuinely doesn't know the rules? Obviously, that's not going to hold up in the court of law, but is there a way to distinguish between, oh, this is just an amateur hunter and somebody who actually just wanted to break the rules because he wanted to get that buck?
Yeah, that definitely does happen. That is a portion of people who, you know, wind up being enmeshed in like a poaching case, right? Like they inadvertently break the law. But, and those aren't the people that Oregon State Police is most, you know, upset about or interested in prosecuting. But at the same time, you know, so it's tricky because it's like, yeah, what if you're going fishing and you don't realize you're not allowed to catch sturgeon at this time of year or what have you, or like, you know, but also if you're going to go fishing, you know, you need to at least read this, you know, ODFW, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, read their website about what are fishing regulations. Do I need a license? Like, you know, you have a responsibility to do some basic education about what these rules are. So like, hopefully, you know, people don't mistakenly poach an animal, fish, etc. But it does happen and can happen. And I've also heard examples from the troopers I've talked to of somebody who shot at a buck, right? And there's different rules for different times of the year and different seasons about what sort of elk you can shoot, depending on how many like points are on their antlers. So I've heard these troopers tell me, there's been a guy who, you know, he thought this was like a 2-point buck, but it actually was a spike, which means its antlers haven't branched out yet. And then he called OSP up and said, hey, I you know, this buck was really far. I really thought like it was a 2-pointer and it wasn't, and I shot it. And, you know, so they figure out, I don't exactly know how those situations conclude. But there is an element of just people like not necessarily knowing or mistakenly doing something. And I just know that that's not really the individuals the state is super like worried about on their end. They're just more interested in educating those people and teaching people like, you need to read up on the rules before you go out and like, you know, take wildlife.
That is really interesting. Tess Riske, our local expert on police and prisons, and now you've gone really deep on this world of poaching. What has that been like to kind of set aside the human stories of, it's still a human story, but you know what I mean? What's the poaching world been like to you for the past couple of weeks that you've been working on in this story?
I hope by local expert, you mean at Willamette Week among the reporters. I'm the one who covers them more. There's certainly more people in the region and more reporters who know more about these topics than I do, but sure, that's a very nice descriptor. It was really fun talking to these different folks. Like, I haven't done a lot of reporting on Oregon State Police at all, which is just because there's so much other stuff happening relating to like the Portland Police Bureau and, you know, prisons in the state. So this is really an agency I haven't had much time to write about. But then, like, you know, obviously it's heavily a wildlife related story. So it's at this cool intersection of like conservation and the criminal justice system, which I don't really get to write a lot about environmental issues and like conservation issues, which are fascinating to me, but just not normally a part of my typical job. So it was really fun. It was fun talking to these troopers whose jobs are just like so different from anything I've experienced. And, you know, they're different from most law enforcement personnel who I've interacted with, in that, you know, they're out a lot of times in like the woods in their region. They're finding these animals, they're doing, you know, like, I forget what the word is, but it's been really cool learning about what their world is like and the efforts that they go to find these individuals. And I just think, like, you know, it was more fun because I knew so little about it. So there was, every conversation was like so many new insights. So it was kind of just refreshing to get to cover it, honestly.
Yeah. And then last question here, you know, I have noticed how social media has started to really impact justice and law enforcement. I think we all saw that in a national scale when the January Capitol riots came. They were filming them inside the Capitol on their cell phones and posting them on Facebook and Snapchat. People were getting arrested because of that. And here again, we have arrests made due to text messages and photos. How have you seen, since you are plugged in and you are the Willamette Week expert, if that's a more comfortable title for you, you are an expert, but how have you seen, it seems like every single time social media is being brought up in these cases now.
Yeah, social media is definitely a big factor in more criminal cases. But what's interesting is I don't even think I would describe this case as social media, because it's texts, right? So it's like private message exchanges, which I don't mean to be a pest to make that distinction. But what I mean is, like, this isn't even based on something that was, you know, people were, sharing online, right? Like, these messages, most of them were recovered using Cellebrite, which is a surveillance technology that Oregon State Police has a contract with to extract deleted messages from William Holling's cell phone. So it's really fascinating because, I mean, this is just one example of the ways that, at least, you know, for Oregon State Police, they use these very like gumshoe methods to go after poachers. Like, they literally like look at footprints, right? And they like find the bullet that, or the casings that are like affiliated with this animal, and will match them to a rifle that they found with a suspect. So they do this really like, you know, old school detective work. And then they mesh it with this very high tech surveillance and bring these two components together. And I think that's probably going to be increasingly common. And I'm sure there's plenty of room for debate about like the ethics and legality of using companies like Cellebrite to, actually prosecute people. So I'm sure we'll probably be seeing more of that in the like years and decades to come, honestly. On those days when I'm really alone, realize the voice I miss is my own. When did I forget how to hold my own head? Still can't understand why did I stop seeking my own comfort.
Well, folks, that's our show. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Dive Podcast. We will catch you next week for episode 42. Till then, stay safe, have fun, keep listening, keep reading. For Willamette Week, I'm Hank Sanders. Take care. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Daily Dive. Thank you to everyone at Willamette Week for your tireless reporting. Thank you to Wilson Hansen, Jack Sanders, and AmpMusic.co for the music you heard on this podcast. If you are interested in sponsoring this podcast or have any general questions or comments, feel free to email me at hsanders@wweek.com. And be sure to come back on Saturdays for the Dive podcast. We'll see you there.